Welcome back to episode number 262 of the Dust Safety Science Podcast. This is a podcast for building a global community around process safety and industries handling combustible dust. I'm your show host, Dr. Chris Cloney. In today's episode, we're discussing what are welding fumes and are they explosible? And we're doing that with Jeremiah Wan, CEO and President of Imperial Systems, based at Mercer, Pennsylvania. Jeremiah, welcome back to the Dust Safety Science Podcast.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me on. Glad to be back.
I'm super excited. It's been a while since we've had Jeremiah on. He was on way back in episode 29, which would be almost 5 years ago now. We have had some of his counterparts on the podcast since then, particularly Donovan Karkai, episode 229 and 159. I think both of those were crossover episodes with the Dusty Jobs podcast. No one's even at the Powder Show at a live recording that we did there with them. Out of curiosity, Jeremiah, I didn't prep you for this, but are you guys still doing the Dusty Jobs podcast? Can people find new episodes of that still on your guys' website?
Yeah, we are. Thanks for asking. It's been a pretty good podcast for us. We that's one of the things we like to do is at the trade shows, we grab industry experts or maybe customers, somebody that's in a specific industry or doing a specific application, and we have them on, you know. And so it's been fun. I don't know exactly how many years that Dusty Jobs has been going, but I think we're at least, you know, time flies, but I would say it's probably been 4 years at least. So it's doing well.
Yeah, I believe it. And the nice thing with that, it's on YouTube as well. And you guys have the videos, which is kind of cool. I've been once at the trade show there, and it's kind of cool to pull people off the floor, talk about their experience, talk about what their specific application are, and get the questions answered there. And that would be something I think folks can access it from your website and also access it from YouTube as well. I was going to say, I was looking back at my notes and thinking about our podcast episode. I couldn't believe that was 5 years ago. I actually remember the discussion quite a bit. We talked, you know, some background Imperial Systems and that, but I remember you talked about testing to destruction. And that was one of the points that stuck in my mind for you guys and the CMAX and the kind of track that you guys take in industry. And it was like, well, what would it actually take to destroy this piece of equipment? And we talked about a lot in that episode, that being an important thing for companies to do. And then some interesting things came out from your testing way back then, which was, I think you guys thought that your system would withstand up to some certain pressure, and the door blew off. And what it was actually a latch that we had, a latch that was weaker than the rest of the system. And we've seen since then, I've seen lots of explosion instances where the latches actually are the failure point. The access hatches are the things that blow off. And it's been kind of interesting. And you were talking about that again 5 years ago, saying we should test this to destruction, understand the way it's going to fail. And that way, I think you guys made some improvements to your welding process to make sure your latches were coming out the same every time and coming out stronger. So I just wanted to kind of start with saying I appreciated that track you guys were taking back then. We might get in some, well, we're going to get some new testing on weld fumes today, but we might get some of your guys' system testing as well. I'm excited to have you back, Jeremiah.
Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah, we were talking a little bit before the podcast started, and I had forgotten that we had that conversation as well. But, you know, that's kind of, you know, how we got into, you know, I mean, you know, I say it all the time. We are the leaders in combustible dust for weld fume applications. And it was all started by a customer, a very large customer that decided to have their dust tested because they were having thermal events in their sandblasting or their shot blasting applications. And they knew that had to be tested, and that was combustible. But then they had the idea that let's go ahead and check the weld fume too. And they went ahead and had it tested and found out that there was a KST that was significantly higher than one. And as we all know, you know, in NFPA, it states that, you know, that anything that has a KST greater than one should be dealt with. In fact, you know, I think it says something about rigorous safety measures should be taken, you know. So now this is going back 8-9 years ago, and kind of people thought we were crazy for, you know, after we took this stance with this customer, and that customer took the stance that going forward that all weld dust would be tested and treated as combustible. We started bringing that to our customers going forward, and they just kind of looked at it as funny. So, you know, I think when you're blazing the trail, it's always a little difficult, but that's what we did. And, you know, here we are 9 years plus later doing the same thing and even doing it better now.
Yeah, that was the second point I wrote down from that podcast episode. You're hitting all the, so episode 29, you find dustsavyscience.com/29 with Jeremiah. If you want to get his viewpoints from a couple of years ago on this stuff, But the other major thing we talked about was, what if customers don't comply? And that really hard question of, okay, we've said there's a, you know, there's a risk here. What if the, and I don't remember your exact answer, and I'm sure that, you know, the answers, I'd be surprised if the identical answer today, 4 or 5 years later, but at least you're willing to have that discussion back then to say, yeah, this is, you know, this is what you have to do. It, I think it ties back to your company culture, how you want to be seen in the market, and what kind of, you know, impact you want to be having on these companies. You may have to say no to a customer at the end of the day, or say this is the right thing to do, rather than, you know, some other tactics. So it was an interesting discussion. I encourage people to go check it out. I want to talk about WellFumes today, but it is worth mentioning. I mean, you guys are across all industries. What kind of industries does Imperial Systems typically work with, and what's sort of the major kind of, I don't know, top five or top six or seven industries that you'd be working with today?
So just so the listeners know, I mean, we spend about 90%+ of our marketing dollars in the metalworking industry. So we are a, you know, metalworking company through and through. But when I founded Imperial Systems, you know, 20 years ago, started it in the third bedroom of my house, I was pretty much pretty deep in the wood industry. So we did a lot of, you know, woodworking, we did flooring plants, we did molding plants, we did pallet shops, actually sold wood grinders for a while for a friend of mine. It was one of the lines that we represented. So we were deep, neck deep into that. And that got us into recycling plastics because we're doing shredders. That got us into any kind of thing you could think of, carpet. And so we, you know, kind of had to become, you know, experts or very knowledgeable in all these applications. But as we continued to kind of trudge through these different industries, metalworking just kept coming up, and we would get involved in a metalworking project. And quite frankly, we were just good at it. I mean, we understood what the pains of the customer was. We have a metalworking shop, you know, and I think if you go to our website and look at our story, I mean, I grew up in the metalworking industry. So from the time I was able to walk, I was working in a fab shop. So it really is in our DNA, and it's who we are. So while we do all different types of applications, and I mean, out in our plant right now, we've got fiberglass, we've got asphalt, we've got plastic. We do a lot in the steel mill industry, and that's not really metalworking. So a lot of people think, well, that steel mill is metalworking, but it's really not. It's different. Because in steel mills, you've got, you know, lime dust, you've got coal dust, you've got all kinds of different minerals. And so you name it, we do it. So, you know, sometimes, you know, I'll tell people some days we'll be in a popcorn factory and the next day we're in Tesla. So you just never really know.
Yeah.
And where you're at. But I will say that anymore, you know, over 90% of all the stuff we do is considered combustible. And that did not used to be the case 10, 15 years ago. Because people just didn't look at their industry. And I think we'll lead into this later with metalworking, but, you know, a long time ago, you know, people would, you know, say, well, it's, you know, our dust isn't combustible. We've been doing this for, you know, fiberglass factories, for instance, they didn't think anything was combustible, but it took, you know, years of education and awareness to bring people to understand that, hey, your dust is combustible and you should have it looked at. So,
yeah.
Pretty much everything we do now is combustible.
Yeah, and I want to dig into this WellFumes side of things. It was interesting. And I don't have the timeline. I have the emails. But so you mentioned 8 or 9 years ago, you guys had started talking about WellFumes. I'd say it was pre-COVID, maybe 3 years ago, we had folks that were reaching out to us. And I'd say in 6 months, I had 4 or 5 consultants, a couple dust collection companies, and a couple test labs email me like within a 6 month span saying, hey, do you know WellFumes are combustible dust? And of course, not my background. I'm like, well, can you explain to me what a WellFume is? Step one. And most couldn't give any sort of idea what a actual WellFume, like what the material makeup of a WellFume might be. Maybe we can cover that. But it seemed like all at once there was quite a bit of questions. And I would say I know of at least 2 or 3 consultants that had WellFumes tested for their clients at those times and found they were combustible dust. And then there's all these questions around, okay, well, you know, why aren't we seeing any incidents? And if we are, you know, like there's just all this kind of question discussion about it. It was kind of strange to me because normally there's a large explosion in an industry that seems to move things forward a bit. In this case, I don't know if the explosion happened. Maybe it did, but I don't know. So it was kind of strange. I guess I want to get your idea on when, you know, did you see that same uptake around a couple of years ago when people started talking about this more? Maybe you guys were the drivers, you did some testing and all the consultants and folks I was talking to were coming from you. Like, why did people start talking about this a couple of years ago, and where did it come from in your perspective?
Well, I don't know exactly where it came from, other than I can tell you nobody was talking about it before we were. I mean, it was not a conversation to be had. And again, I got to thank my customer, which I'm going to leave them anonymous, but they're the ones that, you know, brought it to our attention. So, you know, but that's kind of, you know, who we are. We learn from our customers, and we develop products based on what we learn. So, you know, what their needs are. But, you know, I know that, you know, I wrote an article, it was probably around 6 or 7 years ago, and put it in the Fabricator. It was a article about, you know, weld dust being combustible. And we wrote blogs on it, and we just did our normal social media, you know, marketing that we do. And so I don't know if, you know, that's what it was or not. I can tell you that I had similar experience where I had several people call me and email me asking me, you know, what I knew about this and what we had learned. And so, you know, I'd like to say that I take full responsibility for it, but I'm not going to be that certain of that. But it definitely was around that time where we wrote that article and did all that work. It takes, you know, marketing and awareness to create a safe work environment, you know, especially for an industry like this.
I agree. And I don't talk about this concept too much on the podcast, but I call it selling safety. Like we need to apply the same methodologies if you're going to be selling product and equipment or anything, used car, whatever it is, to selling the safe work processes in general. And that requires awareness, requires the buyer to know that there's a problem in the first place that needs solving, requires figuring out what the best options are to solve that problem. And then it requires moving them from one point in their journey through to the other point in the journey where they're better off after having made that investment in safety. But it's a whole process. And if they're not aware of the hazard at the start, then same as, you know, needing to buy something for back pain. If you're not aware there's even a solution for your back pain or whatever it's going to be, then you need to get kind of that wedge in the door, and having those conversations is a good way to get that awareness going.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think everybody in the metalworking industry wants to have a safer, cleaner environment, right? So it's not a question of whether there's a desire there anymore. I mean, maybe 20, 25, 30, 35 years ago, it was less of a concern. But today, you know, your workers are looking for a cleaner environment, you know, a safer environment. Like there's options. They can go get a job anywhere. And so you have to have a good safety record. Not to mention you have to have a good safety record.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Kind of rewind a bit on this, on weld fumes, and then I'm going to talk about this testing you guys have done and some of the things you've seen with your clients. But when we talk about weld fumes in relation to dust collection, like what applications are we talking about? So when I first heard this, I didn't know what a weld fume was. We talked about that in a second, or we talked about that a few minutes ago. But yeah, what are the applications where weld fumes are being collected in general that you're working with?
Right. Well, it's very broad. So, you know, you've got your typical, you know, fab shop where guys are working with, you know, MIG welders and they're on their benches with, you know, relatively small welders, but it's a job shop where they're welding all over the shop, and sometimes they're going to the product to be welded, and other times the products are just coming to their cells. So in this kind of an environment here, that application is typically most suited for an ambient, you know, type system. Not to go into great detail of what that is, but that's basically just where you're putting ventilation directly over top of the work areas. I mean, not like hooded, but just over top and doing so many air changes per minute or per hour in a work zone, right? And so that would be an application. The other application would be where you know, they're welding, you know, maybe robotic welders, right? And that's becoming more and more popular right now with the shortage of workers. So robotic cells, it's funny, if you go to FabTech, you know, the last FabTech we went to, I mean, just the amount of robots were just insane. In fact, we had one in our booth. I think you were there and saw it, but
yeah,
they robots are everywhere. And those are a little easier to capture because you can usually put a hood, you know, right over the cell and capture that smoke. So that's maybe another application, a lot easier to capture. And then there's all kinds of other applications where, you know, maybe they're inside of a vessel that has to have, you know, additional suction or ventilation in that close confined area. Yeah. So I'm trying to think, so it'd be like just basically like MIG, TIG, robot, freehand. And then also, you know, in a fab shop, you've also got grinding, and you've got heavy torch cutting or plasma cutting that has to be considered as well. So I think that pretty much covers it.
I kind of got three here. I got ambient capture, I'll call it source capture, like where you actually have a point that you can put a hood on, and then other systems. And that could be cutting, grinding, polishing. You know, we're probably going to circle around because this was one of the things that I, when people start asking me the question, there seemed to be some confusion between these three things, and in particular, the looping in cutting applications and that sort of stuff into the WealthBeam application on what was actually collected. So, I mean, you guys did some testing in this area. You mentioned one set of tests you guys did that had a KSD value, a rate of pressurize through standardized testing. Have you done other testing for other clients, or, you know, what kind of testing have you guys done for WealthBeams, and what did you find out through this testing?
Yeah, so we have done testing. What we do is we request our customer to get to that they get testing, right? So we'll give them the information. They can either send the sample to us and we'll send it off to have it tested, or we'll just give them the information. They can send it and have it done themselves. So we don't always get those tests back, but we do get information back from them as far as, you know, what is the KST of the dust and how do we need to address it. So pretty much every weld fume, cutting or grinding, anything in the metalworking industry, we educate them, tell them it's a good idea, and that we're seeing that almost all of them are combustible to have it tested. And then, you know, just recently, one of the things we did was we have, so in our plant, we have on our laser, on our plasma. So these are dust collectors. So we have on our laser, on our plasma, on our robot, we have two on our ambient systems, one on our powder coat line, and then one in our R&D department in our filtration plant. So those are, I guess that's six dust collectors that we have. And those are both Shadows and C-Maxes. We had to address them just like we do with anybody else, right? So we have to make sure that we're doing things safely and per an FPA. So recently we said, you know, when we put the plant in, it's been 7 or 8 years ago, and you know, with COVID anymore, you can almost say 7 or 8. I'm really bad at that. You know, I've been saying that a lot today, like 8 or 9 years or so. Right? Then you can add 3 years to that, right? But we put these ambient systems in and we never did do testing on them just because we were just putting the plant in and we just wanted to get the collectors in. So we put them in, probably like most people do. But just recently I said, hey guys, have we ever had those ambient units tested for combustible dust? And the answer I found out was no, we had not. So we sent the dust sample out to get tested. Now, again, in this area, probably there's really no cutting per se, because we don't do a lot of free cutting. We do everything with a laser or plasma, all CNC, so it's closed capture. But in this area, you're talking about MIG welders. There's probably 20 MIG welders, and then they do some grinding, right? So we sent the dust out and had it tested, and I'm looking at the report right now, and it came back at a 58 KST, which was just shocking to me, because I would have guessed, you know, it would have been maybe less than 20. But 58.
Yep.
So that to me was shocking. So we're actually in the process right now of addressing that, because we've got to make sure we have the proper safety devices on that. And I can talk about that in a minute, what we're going to do. But, you know, the NFPA says, like I said earlier, if it's greater than one, it has to be dealt with. And, you know, rigorous safety measures, you know, proper dust management, ventilation, explosion mitigation systems, employee training. You know, there's just a few things I took notes on, and that's all in NFPA 652 and 484. So anyways, that's just an example. Now, I will tell you that we don't consider that to be metal dust. Now, that's something probably we could talk about a little bit. You're not, you know, when you're talking ambient, in our particular case, we're 30 feet away from the source. We're just collecting just the smoke and the fume that gets turned out into the room and is able to rise to the ceiling. Now, if you're doing something where you've got closed capture, like whether they're flex arms or a robotic weld cell where you're right over top of the welding, that you're probably can have it tested, but also should just probably consider that to be metal dust, because metal dust has to be handled a little bit different than non-metallic dust. Just because of the extreme pressures and the temperature that it can get when it explodes.
Yeah, and I want to cycle through a couple of pieces here, because you mentioned a lot of important stuff. So you mentioned KST ranges. There's a few things on KST. So one, well, let's do good news, bad news. So KST less than 50 barometer a second in ASTM E1226 and the concentration standard as well, there is some discussion around 20-liter testing and whether or not it can properly evaluate KSDs below 50. There is a possibility in some cases that that test may be overdriven and you can do testing in other ways. And this is something you have to tell your testing provider about to see if it truly does represent an explosion hazard at industrial conditions. Now, that being said, I've seen cases where you do the testing, say in a 1 cubic meter chamber, and it's no longer explosible. I've seen cases for metal dust where it's even worse in larger. So it's unclear. I guess there's uncertainty if it's less than 50 bar meter second. Maybe good news. I don't know. The bad news, Haganese iron dust, KSD 19 bar meter second was the rating. Two flash fires and explosion that took multiple lives in each incident. So located, and that's why you see things in, say, in the FPA standards that KSD above, like any KSD, any rate of pressurized means there's a deflagration hazard, and you put those things in place. So there's kind of two sides of that. The testing standard, just the way the 20-liter chamber is and how much energy is used in that test, it doesn't work so well in sort of the margins where stuff doesn't explode really strongly. And so sometimes it can be over conservative. That being said, if the stuff is shown to explode in industry applications, even with low 5, 10, 15 bar meter second rates of pressurized, that's enough to kill. So it needs to be addressed at the end of the day. So there's that piece. You mentioned some really, so I didn't catch it till the very end, but you said that dust that you guys tested from the ambient, that's smoke and fumes that are rising. That's not like at the source where you're cutting, you're grinding, you're getting that metal off. This is something else that you're capturing. I think that's one of the confusions that I ran across with some consultants was, well, what are they capturing? They didn't know. It's like, well, it might be fumes, but they might be also getting some stuff off grinding and cutting. It's like, well, you need to know what it is. So the metal side, I got that. It makes a lot of sense. Combustible dust, IPA 44, there's enhanced challenges. For those fumes and smoke, have you guys ever tested like what element that is or what physical material that is that once it condenses into a dust? Because I don't know. That was my first question. Nobody could really answer it. It's like maybe it's a burnt. I don't know. Do you know what, when you collect that smoke, what does it condense into?
Well, that's a good question. And to be honest with you, I was hoping to have this back by the time we do this podcast. So we may have to follow up with another podcast or just to follow up to this, but we're looking for, right now we have a source located to do it, but we're going to have an analysis done of the dust. I think it's an electro
SEM scanning, electron microscope, I think probably.
So anyway, we're sending that off and having that test ring. So I want to know exactly what the composition of that dust is. Now, if I was just going to guess, you think about it, the stuff that is pretty lightweight that will float all the way up there is your grinding dust, from all the flap discs and everything. I mean, one thing is you've been to our booth and you've seen our equipment firsthand, but I mean, all of our welds are ground smooth. I mean, all of our, our C-Maxes and our shadows are just built really well. And so we kind of go to great lengths to make sure that the product is a very nice looking product when the customer gets it. So we do a lot of grinding in our shop. And so I'm assuming that you've got all the binders from those flap discs and some of the, so there's nylon in those and there's paper in those. There's all kinds of that kind of combustible type stuff. So I'm assuming when we get that test back, that's what you're going to see a lot of.
Yep. Yeah. It's funny. I did that a number of years ago during my academic degree. I had some samples of iron, had three samples, and I tested them and they were completely. So I wanted to do a fundamental assessment and this was shipped from, I don't know, an iron producer or some company. And I said, here's three buckets of the same stuff. And so before running my tests, I just tested all three buckets to see, okay, well, what is it? And they were completely different KSTs. Mm. So I no longer could do my study because I need to have three samples that were the same, sort of like relatively same thing. But I did take them, how did I do it? Yeah, I did. So I put them into an epoxy. I think I cut into the epoxy and then I took an SEM scanning electron microscope and scanned them to see what is this stuff? And one was, mostly iron. One was iron with a whole bunch of chromium and all sorts of, other exotic metals. And one was, no wonder there's three different KSTs. They're not even the same thing. I talked to the site and said, we scooped this one from here, this one from here, this one from here. And so it's a good point. It completely busted my study. I wasn't able to do it because I didn't have enough of any one set of samples to do what I wanted to do. But I ended up publishing a study of the scanning electron microscope stuff, just saying, hey, if you got three, you have different elements and you're going to get different results basically at the end of the day.
Well, I think it'd be valuable to do it because, like, you're not going to, if you send that into to, you know, Fike or Baker or somebody like that, that does testing, they're not going to do that level of,
yeah,
of detail for you. They're just giving you the KST, basically the PMAX and the KST and all that. But the, but I think though, from an industry standpoint, it'd be good to have that knowledge. Just think about it. I mean, what if it is the majority of it is, you know, the type of polishing or grinding we're doing or whatever. And if that's the case, maybe we can engineer some of that stuff out of there that's combustible. So I think it'd be valuable to share that with the industry and let them know what our findings is. So,
So,
you know, there's a way to maybe a way to engineer around that. We can get rid of that because quite honestly, there's a lot of money spent on, you know, on mitigation when it comes to combustible dust on, you know, weld fume. And so if we could save some money and still make a safe work environment, then that would be good.
Yeah. I feel like every time we talk, Jeremiah, we get back to, we need better testing. So what I required our testing lab and university to do after, required is a strong word, what I suggested that they do is never test a sample again without taking full particle size distribution and without doing an elemental analysis of it, because both are relatively inexpensive to do if you have the equipment. If you don't have the equipment, it's pretty expensive equipment, but if you have the equipment, and then you can kind of tell, you have your PMAX, your KST, your MEC, but then you also have, this is what it is, like physically what material it's made of, what elements are involved, and also particle size and full particle size distribution, not the 50% below 75 micro, like that doesn't tell you anything. You could have five samples that all say 50% below 75 micron and those be completely different things. So you need to actually plot the entire histogram. And that will give you some idea because it's usually only the bottom 10% of the histogram that's even reacting in the first place and it's leaving all the other stuff behind. So anyway, that's very rare. Some research studies do that level of assessment for each test, but yeah, it's valuable to understand then the hazards that I shouldn't say it. We built the whole economy up on applying engineering rules of guidance on top of the type of test we have. So that's very valuable. But if you want to understand things from a fundamental level, then you need that level of characterization to start to look at it.
All right. I mean, that's a good point. Yeah, I was just reading the report and it said there was no sieving necessary and there was no particle size distribution. So yeah.
Yeah. You never see that stuff in a, very rarely would see it in an industry report. And that's fine. They've designed the test. The theory is they've designed the test to be conservative overall scenarios and that stuff doesn't matter as much. So what is it? That was my first question. My second question is how much do you actually get at the end of the day? So I get if you're attached to a grinder, if you're attached to a grinder or a cutter, then you would end up getting more material. But from the ambient kind of fume collection side of things, do you actually get much material at the end of the day? Like, is it grams or kilograms or, well, you guys wouldn't be measured in grams and kilograms, I guess, but is it pounds and tons or like, do you get enough collecting in the ducting and in the system to be an explosion hazard? And what does that look like from your guys' experience?
You know, that's a solid question and it is interesting. So definitely on any closed capture, you're going to get a lot more, right?
Yeah.
Any direct hood above it. So like your robotic weld cells, you're going to get a lot more concentration. You're going to fill up your receptacles a lot faster. But I will tell you on ambient system, and it almost, I mean, we've literally had customers ask us like, where is the dust, you know, because, and I'll tell you for example, and I think I'm on a podcast here, so I'll be right. But I think it was about 7 or 8 years ago when we had when we put these collectors in. And I don't know how many times the drums, the 55-gallon drums have been emptied underneath them, but it's been very few. What I can tell you is that a couple of things I can tell you about it is one, the dust that's in there, if you put your hand through it, it's like liquid, you know, the way that it's so fine.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever experienced that before or not, but it's like, you know, almost like carbon black where you put your hand in there and it just kind of looks like liquid. Zero resistance, almost no bulk density, just very, very light. So I think that's the fume nature of it. But what I will tell you is that I can walk out into our plant and within a second, I can tell you if just one of the ambient systems is turned off. So our guys at the morning shift, they go over there and hit the collector and it fires up and it runs all day long. But sometimes, just like anywhere, a guy will forget to turn them on. and you can tell instantly. So I guess why I'm saying that is that there is a significant difference.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you're collecting. That's the,
when you put that collector in it. Yeah. Then when it's not in. So on one hand, I'm saying that they work amazingly well and we can't live without them. And that's what our customers would say too, and have said. But on the other hand, I'm telling you that it's like, I don't know where all the dust goes, you know? So it's just a fine amount of dust with a low density that I just think the accumulation takes a long time to fill up. So, you know, I guess the short answer is that, yeah, there is enough dust that we can get to test, but it doesn't build up very fast.
Yeah. Especially when you compare it to something that would be more common, like a dust collector collecting coal or
shot blast or something like that. Yeah.
Where you're just getting drums and drums and drums of stuff. Right.
Yeah. Heavy density. I mean, now I'll tell you now here's a complete different scenario. We have another customer that I've been dealing with for a long time now. We have several collectors in with them. Very good customer of ours. They make, it's called wear plate. So what I mean is they'll take regular, just, you know, A36 carbon steel sheets, and they've got these robotic welders that weld, you know, if it's quarter plate, they'll weld an additional quarter inch of high chrome, you know, weld laminate on top. So it's used for coal mining applications and buckets on skid steers and backhoes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Now on that, they're doing, they'll have 7 or 8 weld heads, big, heavy MIGs running all day long, just zigzagging back and forth, you know, and this, you know, maybe 2-3 shifts. So we'll have a 3 or 4 inch hose and a hood down to each MIG on these robots. So they may have, you know, 20 or 30 MIGs running robotically, 3 shifts a day. Now that you'd be shocked to see what we did there. So that one, we actually took we ran it through multiple dust collectors. We come outside and we've got a long auger that goes out. It's like an 8-inch diameter auger, long auger that comes out of the bottom of the dust collector, goes down to another cross auger that drops down into these 40-yard roll-off hoppers, you know, like your dumpster hoppers.
Yep.
We put lids on top of those. And then I'm probably confusing you here, but inside of those, we put augers. And the reason we did that is, so what we're doing is, we got so much weld fume that, you know, a couple of times a week, they'll have to come with a service truck will come in and pull those 40-yard hoppers, and they're all full of weld fume.
Yeah.
So that's an extreme application, right? But in welding, just gives you an idea, like how we can go from an ambient system that might produce, you know, a 50-gallon drum a year to that, where you're doing a 40-yard hopper full of weld fume in 2 days.
Yeah. As we get more robotics, more faster systems, we have, you know, higher throughput. We're not aware that these type of hazards and talking about them, then that's where we run into some of these dangers. And so I didn't have this list prepared, but when I start to ask people the question about weld fumes, I'll mention some of like the one-off comments that would come out. So one, it's already reacted, so it can't be it can't react again. It's like the carbon, or it's a soot version of what's reacted. So it has no reactive stuff in it. Two, it's only weld fume. There's nothing else, you know. And then I'd ask, like, well, is there any, you know, what are they doing with the grinders? And like, oh, well, maybe there's some other stuff in there. Three, they blanket just say, well, there's no way you'd collect enough to be a hazard, even if it was reactive. And I think we've disproven at least all three of those, as, you know, they were just like knee-jerk statements I'd hear, and I'd be like, oh, really? And I still don't know the answers to all them. Like, that stuff that's coming out of those roll away hoppers, I assume that's kind of what you're talking about, like the liquid, the really fine stuff that you can kind of put your hand, like, my question still is, like, what is that? And you guys said you were looking at, so like, what element is that?
Well, that one I would say, and that's definitely going to be more of your spent, you know, burnt, you know, wire, impurities that coming out of the steel, and, you know, all the smoke that's generated from the impurities. And
so same thing about, I think about fly ash.
Yeah.
So fly ash is supposed to be combusted material, but it's not. It's very common to have fly ash dust collector explosion, because only 30% of the material, or 80 or whatever, reacted, and there's still 20% left in that fly ash. The same thing I would assume would be true. I shouldn't say, I'm unsure if the same thing's true in weld fume or not, because the mechanism by which it goes from a a gas back to a solid. I studied that for several years, but I was doing aluminum vapors, and you don't commonly hear aluminum vapors unless you hear them in welding, but it was from high explosives. They put metallized aluminum in high explosives and they vaporize and then it recondense back to the same phase. So I looked at some of the physics of that, but I don't know what a weld fume in general is going to be. If it's aluminum and it vaporizes and then recondenses, it's aluminum with some alumina, the reacted oxide that's not true. It actually burns as well. But anyway, so yeah, I don't know what the material is. The summary is you need to do the testing, Jeremiah, and tell me what.
We should do more. Yeah, I'll do more, and I'll be glad to share it with you. I think this may be kind of a challenge for me to do more of that. So once I get this first report back, I'll share it with you at least offline just to see what.
Yeah.
What you have as far as input goes, and then we can do more. I mean, it's the same thing. For instance, we do a lot with plasma dust collectors, like CNC plasmas and CNC lasers. There are a lot of customers that say, well, we don't want to, they may be doing aluminum, cutting aluminum, and they're like, Well, it's spent. I'm like, well, no, we've seen tests come back with the higher KSTs, and it needs to be addressed. They don't want to do anything. And so, it's like, I think you opened up with this statement earlier. It's like, what do you do if the customer doesn't want to do something? And so I think if I'm not mistaken, I can't cite exactly where it's at, but in the NFPA, it does state somewhere that it's ultimately the customer's responsibility to follow the NFPA and the guidelines and the safety mandates. I mean, we are experts, but ultimately, we can just educate them so far. Now, if we get into some application where, I've been in applications before where I knew it was highly combustible and I just told them we weren't going to do it unless we did the combustible, the measures, the mitigation. And I don't think I've ever had to walk away from one, but I think we've had a couple pretty tough conversations. But,
yeah,
we got to do the right thing. For us, we have to be able to lay our head down at night and sleep good. And we've just seen too many. I mean, I personally been on. On sites within a couple of days after explosions, were not my company's doing, but where I've seen them firsthand, where there's been casualties, and it's just something I don't want to be part of. Unfortunately, in our business, we're growing, at a very rapid pace, and we sell a lot of dust collectors, and a lot of them we don't even know. I mean, we sell them through through reps or dealers or OEMs, and I mean we really don't know where they all go. And so it's our job to do this is beautiful right here. I mean, where we can, educate more people about the risks or that first article that I wrote about, combustible dust and weld fume. I mean, it's just like, we got to educate people so they can make the right decisions.
Yeah. If somebody is going to move forward with protection of these systems, what kind of things are you guys doing today for, is there a standard set of protection they're doing on ambient welding equipment, or is it still dependent on the application and what they need at the end of the day? What's kind of your guys' first set of go-to recommendations for folks in the protection side?
Well, the good news is, it's not as expensive as it used to be, right? So it's the price, I feel like the price, prices haven't come down anywhere.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's a lot easier to do now than it used to be. You can either, you can either go with, chemical or a, I got what they call it, passive
or active systems. So venting or chemical suppression.
Yeah, passive or active. I apologize. Yeah, so passive or active. And so, the active would be your chemical, right? And so with that, we do, a lot of these large, automated, weld facilities. There's really no other way to go but to do an active type system. So we've got at that point, we'll put canisters on the inlet of the collector. We'll put canisters on the collector itself. And then sometimes, depending on what we're doing, we'll do it on the outlet. Now, I will tell you that our C-Max has had the primary filters tested by a third party and certified to stop an explosion from returning back through the return air. Now that's up to 200 KST, and that, that does work in certain applications. So we can use that. If we can't use that, if it gets above 200 KST or it's just not the right application, then we just simply put a canister on the outlet side and we're good to go. We can do flameless vents. Flameless vents are where if we need to vent the collector and we need to do it inside or maybe even outside where we don't have a lot of room to do the vent, We can do flameless vents, which are basically just an explosion vent with a housing around it and a series of stainless steel mesh screens. So those are, you know, those are again all made by somebody other than us. We buy and resell those, and they're pretty inexpensive anymore. There's several companies that make them. So there's the chemical, then there's the passive. So the passive would be
traditional venting and flameless venting and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, flameless vent. But then we do the EIVs or the backdraft dampers on the inlet side. And now sometimes you can do those on the outlet side. So protect the inlet and the outlet with those. You can do fast acting slide gates. You know, there's several ways to do it. It's all pretty easy anymore. On our particular ambient system inside, we're using our IDA, our primary filters for the return air. And then we're doing the EIV valves, which are just a flap style valve on the inlet.
Yep.
And we're protected. And so, you know, our units have all been tested. You know, that's the other thing I wanted to say too, is like, you know, we've spent a lot of money testing our equipment, you know, and when I say testing, I mean, third party tested.
The destruction, as we discussed.
Destruction. Yeah. Destruction, you know, having these things blown up, you know, over and over and over again. And it's you know, on paper, it doesn't make sense because it's very expensive. You know, and it's not just the cost to pay the facilities to do it. But it's, you know, you've got to destroy the equipment. You've got the shipping cost that goes with it. I mean, you know, you've got a truckload of filters that has to go out every time you do the testing because they get destroyed and burned up. But we've learned so much from it. I can't even imagine now, basically knowing what I know now, I can't even imagine selling a piece of our equipment without having third-party testing done on the, you know, the combustible dust testing, or to know what the PRED of the equipment is, just because, or the PMAX of the equipment, because you just never know. I'm sorry, the PRED, maybe it'd be the strength of the vessel.
Yeah.
But you really got to know what that is. Cause even today, if we size it for how many vents we put on there, we know because we did the testing. Right. It's not just some sort of calculation that an engineer does, which is fine. That's a static test, but to do a real true dynamic test to actually see where these little weaknesses are. And like I mentioned on the first podcast, your weakness might not be the door hinge itself or the latch itself. It might be more of the process in which you manufacture it, assemble it, and weld it. And that's not going to show up on some sort of manufacturer spec in a latch book or something like that. Or a gasket book. So, I mean, you know, we do this stuff because we learn from it, and we feel better at the end of the day that we make a better product, and you know, that's why we do it. So,
yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. I said it last time we talked on the podcast. I'll say it again today. I appreciate that process, and I appreciate companies that blow stuff up in the space. Like if you see the difference. So, for example, I'll give an example. You mentioned you've been on site after a large explosion event. That changes your perception, right? If you're a consultant in this space and you haven't actually been able to get out to any of the test labs to see a lab scale explosion or to see a full scale explosion, it's very hard for you to anticipate, you know, what event's going to be. And even worse, if you're selling equipment that's supposed to contain a dust explosion, it would be really good to have your team go out and go to Fike or go to Baker Risk or whoever it's going to be that has a test lab, FM Global, SRI, whoever's going to, and actually witness some of these explosions firsthand so that they have the experience of oh, that's what this thing's, that's why this matters at the end of the day. So I appreciate people that actually go through and get that experience, and then even more so on their own equipment so they know the weak points as well.
That's a great point you bring up though, is, you know, this last test, I was unable to go. I had another commitment. Actually, we were doing FabTech, and so I couldn't get away from FabTech. I sent a crew of three guys down there, some engineers and one of our service techs, and they came back so fired up. They're like, man, what if we do this or what if we do that? And they just, like, you know, it just changed their whole world and their perspective of what we do. And then they're like, holy crap, that, you know, the minute you stand in, you know, 20 feet away from a collector that, you know, is being exploded to a 9 or 10 PSI explosion, it's frightening, you know, but then they realize, like, well, crap, all of our equipment is exposed to that every single day. And there's workers right next to it. So, it was very, very powerful for my team to go see, what they saw. So yeah, good stuff for sure.
Couldn't agree more. I think that's a great place to close off this episode of the podcast, Jeremiah. I want to say thank you for coming on again today, sharing your experience in this area. I think I don't think we solved valve fumes on this podcast, but we definitely identified there's lots of questions that need to be answered, and they'll become more and more important the more that these type of systems are used, especially at higher rates, collecting more materials. You know, it's good to keep in front of the curve on the hazards that are being developed here. So I want to say thank you again. Thank you for the team, for what you guys do down there. And hopefully we'll have you back on the podcast in the future.
All right, Chris. Thanks so much. Good talking to you.
Thanks so much. We'll talk soon. So you've been listening to myself, Dr. Chris Cloney, and Jeremiah Wan, CEO and president at Imperial Systems based out of Mercer, Pennsylvania. We were talking about actually a whole number of topics, but the original topic was weld fumes and are they explosible? We talked through that quite a bit. We talked about what is a weld fume? Is there enough of it to actually have a hazard in the first place? Is it a combustible dust? We talked about testing there. We talked about, is there other stuff that's being collected? If it's a source collection, or if it's, you know, attached to other equipment like lasers or grinders or cutting wheels, or if they're doing hand grinding. And these all to say, if they're doing hand grinding, you know, what is the disc that they're grinding with? That's going to get sucked up as well. So the answer to the question of what is a weld fume is actually not quite that trivial. It encompasses a lot more things. So at the end of the day, I think the only answer is going to be to test your dust at this stage, and then to start to understand the hazards from there. And it sounds like there's still some work going on in this area. Jeremiah mentioned some testing that they're doing at Imperial Systems. Hopefully we get some access to that and share that out once it becomes available to the community as well. And we talked a little more broadly about the impact of testing in combustible dust and its impact on consultants, on equipment manufacturers. It's a really useful thing to be looking at as well. Well, I will include in the show notes for this episode a couple links, including the past podcast episode we did with Jeremiah, also the past podcast episodes for the Dusty Job podcast with Donovan Karkai and the team over at Imperial Systems. We'll include a way to contact Jeremiah and connect with him as well. We also did a really nice article in the Dust Safety Journal in issue 8, talking about the fire and explosion protection systems from solutions from Imperial Systems. So in addition to their C-Max and their Shadow and their other dust collectors, what other you know, type of fire and explosion protection systems do they have available, either through resellers or that they produce as well? They have some spark traps and drums and airlocks, along with the EIVs and the flameless and traditional venting systems as well. So I think we'll leave it at that for this episode. If you have questions about weld fumes, send them through. I definitely recommend connecting with Imperial Systems. They are, you know, one of the companies leading the charge in trying to figure this out, and also one of the companies that's working, you know, the most in this area, at least North America-wise, with the work that they're doing. So I want to say thank you, as always, for listening to the Dust Safety Science Podcast. Hope you have a safe, productive week ahead. I appreciate everything you're doing in interest handling combustible dust to make it safer with the work you do out there every day. Keep it up.